One day when I went out to my wood pile, or rather my pile of stumps, I observed two large ants. The one red, the other much larger, nearly half an inch long and black, fiercely contending with one another. Having once got hold, they never let go, but struggled and wrestled and rolled on the chips incessantly. Looking farther, I was surprised to find that the chips were covered with such combatants, that it was not a duellum, but a bellum, a war between two races of ants, the red always pitted against the black, and frequently two red ones to one black. The legions of these Mimedons covered all the hills and vales in my woodyard, and the ground was already strewn with the dead and dying, both red and black. In Walden, Henry Thoreau took a close look at the conflict among ants, but if he had looked more closely, he would have found that they're much more intriguing in the conduct of their everyday lives, and that they have a greater effect upon humans than we might realize. I'm Norman Gilliland.
I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
The symbiotic relationship between ants and aphids, well, is pretty well known, but it turns out that ants are also cultivators and grow fungus, which in turn involves bacteria and has an impact upon what we grow in our gardens and may have impacts upon our health as well. What is the connection between ants and fungus and us? Our guest is Cameron Curry, professor of bacteriology at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Most of us think of ants as the things we try to get rid of from our kitchen or the, you know, the anthills that we see outside. But what makes them an ideal species for you to study?
Ants are really important in many ecosystems, are ecologically dominant throughout most of the terrestrial ecosystems on the planet. And so they're important to study for many different aspects and make good model systems in some places. But I specialize on symbiosis, and so my study system is ants that are symbiotically associated with microbes.
And by symbiosis, where they're mutually helpful to each other?
Yeah, so the definition of symbiosis was coined by Anton de Berry in the 1800s, and he coined it in a way to imply that there was no known, the extent of the relationship wasn't known, whether it was positive or negative for the players, and just in the sense of could be mutualistic, could be parasitic, could be kind of a neutral association. More recently, people have been using symbiosis as a synonym for mutualism, but we've moved back to kind of symbiosis as two organisms that live in close association. And this is kind of important because many microbes associated with humans and organisms in the environment could have negative effects in some conditions, could have positive effects in others. And so there's a context dependence of interactions between organisms.
So how does it go, a day in the life of an ant?
The day of a life of a fungus-growing ant, which is the group I must focus on. This group is composed of a lot of diversity and occurs throughout the New World. And these ants are specialized in culturing fungus for food. And so they, are basically farmers, and they engage in elaborate behaviors for tending their fungus garden. And they send out workers to collect material for growing their fungus garden. And these workers find, different substrates, and they bring them back to their nest, and they put it in their garden, and they plant this fungus on this material. And then they feed on the fungus. So they're probably, arguably, the first organisms on the planet who practice agriculture, growing their own fungus for food.
And how far back in time do you think this goes?
Ants are thought to originate maybe 100 million years ago, maybe 110 million years ago. And the tribe of ants that I work on, the fungus growers, we think originated between 45 million and 60 million years ago. So a while before we were here.
And is this fungus something that we can see, or is it down in the hill somewhere?
The fungus they grow is related to fungi that produce fruiting bodies that we call mushrooms. And the common mushroom that we buy in the grocery store is the equivalent of what you'd recognize as a fruiting structure of the fungus the ants culture. But the ants culture the more microscopic component of that mushroom, the mycelial component of it. And so most of the time you don't see this kind of fungus in natural systems. But in the case of the ants, you actually, with your naked eye, can see their fungus garden. And it's a elaborate kind of spongy material. In some species, the fungus garden is about the size of a walnut. In other species, they have fungus gardens that might be the size of a melon. And some colonies will have hundreds of these garden chambers with these melon-sized gardens that are interconnected. And so it's kind of neat in this system. You actually can see the microbial mutualist, this fungus.
Is that all they need to eat?
You know, I'm generalizing here. We have 50 million years of evolution and a lot of differences between different groups of fungus-growing ants. But the most well-known fungus-growing ants are what we call the leafcutters. And leafcutters use fresh leaf material for growing their fungus garden. And this group can actually reach really large colony sizes. I know your listeners can't see the room we're in here, but this would be the equivalent of a size of a leafcutting ant nest. It might be 10 feet deep underground, 10 by 10 by 10 in terms of volume. And the reason they can reach these large colony sizes is because they use this fresh leaf materials. So to get back to your question, the workers go out and collect leaf material and they use it to feed the fungus garden. And these workers will get some energy from the plant sap that they forage on. But the brood that are reared, the larvae and the young of the ants that are reared in the fungus garden, and they get all their nutrients from the fungus the ants culture. And the queen feeds on the fungus as well.
And does the fungus serve any other purpose other than food? Does it have any other benefit?
Not that we know of. The fungus is thought to convert the plant biomass into energy, and as we may get into later, that's unclear and it might be more complex than we think. But the primary thing is it serves as a food source. And if the ants lose their fungus, if the fungus dies or gets overgrown, the ants won't survive. They're obviously dependent on the fungus.
And do they have sort of special adaptations? You know, do they look different than other ants or have something that makes them able to do this?
They have a lot of adaptations that are associated with growing fungus gardens. And some of them are just modifications of ways other ants kind of are structured morphologically in terms of their body parts and these kinds of things, or alteration of their physiology for fungus growing. But the most elaborate changes are behavioral. They engage in specific behaviors for tending the fungus garden and cleaning it. They actually prune the fungus, and this increases the growth of the fungus. They weed the fungus garden. When diseases get in, they'll actually remove infected parts and put it in the dump, and they closely groom the fungus of potentially parasitic microbes.
Specific leaves that they feed this fungus that these leaf cutters harvest?
This is one of the amazing things about leaf-cutting ants is most herbivorous insects, most insects that feed on plant material, feed on one or two plant species, and they're specialized and adapted to overcome the defenses of the plant. The ants are actually, in the ecosystems they occur, are able to forage on an estimated 30% of plant species, which, you know, is an incredible adaptation. And so they've actually been described, it's been described as an unholy alliance. And the idea being that the activity of the ants of collecting the leaf material is difficult for plants to defend against. And then they use the fungus to detoxify the compounds of the leaves. And so the plants have a very difficult time defending from the activity of both of the players. And so the ants in the ecosystems they occur are one of the dominant herbivores. They forage on a large amount of plant material. And when humans have tried to cultivate crops in these ecosystems, when Europeans started colonizing the New World, they tried to bring crops from the Old World. And there's many reports and historical accounts about the ants devastating these crops. And so part of the issue is that these crops from the Old World had no ability to protect themselves from the ants, not having been exposed to them before.
Are the ants then, are they... they're harvesting these leaves to feed to the fungus, or they're eating them themselves and feeding them to the fungus?
They only get plant sap from the leaves, so very little of the plant biomass, but the majority of it's fed to the fungus, and then they feed on the fungus. And it seems really quite foreign in terms of thinking about natural systems, but a lot of insects that feed on plants have microbes associated with their internal gut system that help them process the plant biomass. In this case, the ants just have it as an external stomach. So they have these fungi, as we're discovering in work we're doing in the garden. There's other microbes that, you know, convert this plant biomass into energy.
Is it a little bit like having a compost heap in terms of what happens?
It's a little bit like that. There are some differences, and there is a compost heap component to leaf-cutting ants. There is breakdown of the plant biomass to some extent in the fungus garden, but it's more of the fresh material in the leaf-cutting ants. But amazingly, the ants actually have specialized dumps or mounds. And so the plant material goes into the top of the fungus garden. And then over 4 or 6 weeks, it gets partly decomposed, and then it gets removed from the bottom, the undecomposed component, and it actually gets discarded in specialized dumps or mounds. And that's their compost heap. And these are pretty neat little niches that actually can build up and be quite large. And there's specific ants that are – their job is to tend the dump, and there's other ants that it's their job to take the old garden material and place it in the dump. And some work by some European scientists has even shown that the workers that tend the dump or the workers that carry out the dump are not allowed to come back in the colony, and other workers will fight them off.
So they're like untouchables or something.
Because they become contaminated somehow?
Exactly. Other workers don't want to come in contact with them and because they're contaminated with disease in the trash. And as you can imagine, our own human experience with dealing with large population size and a lot of trash, disease can accumulate in this material. And so the ants actually have evolved in their social structure to prevent the cross-contamination of these trash workers coming back in and potentially vectoring disease into their colony.
I have to ask you sort of a practical question. Are you observing in the lab week after week ant behavior? And I mean, is this under a microscope? Is this with lots of assistants who are watching the ants day and night?
A lot of people who work on ants spend a lot of time watching and observing the behavior of the ants. And we do a little bit of that in my lab, but our work is a little bit more on the microbial side, the symbiosis side of the system. And to work on that side of things, we use different approaches, although we do some behavioral observations. But the system is really nice for working in ant behavior because you can maintain these ant colonies in the lab. Here in my lab at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, I have maybe 60 leaf-cutting ant colonies that are in boxes. And we actually have in the microbial science building, we are putting up a live nest of leaf-cutting ants in a big exhibit in the microbe place in the microbial science building. And we'll have a very large leaf-cutting ant nest. So it's great for viewing and general public to look at. And we're going to have a camera, the digital camera, with a live stream online so people can watch the ants themselves from home. And so we actually end up getting caught up watching the ants because they're fascinating to watch, but our work is not so focused on the behavioral component.
I guess I'm curious about how the ants know that they're a worker, you know, or the one that tends the dump, whether it's built into their DNA somehow.
It's a great question, and some aspect of that is still unknown. And what we do know is that in leaf-cutting ants, there's different castes, what we call different castes. And the caste system in leaf-cutting ants can be divided in two ways. One is based on size, and one is based on age. And so older workers can do a different task than younger workers. And so I just was describing how you have trash workers. And so in the trash workers, these are actually the oldest workers in the colony. The youngest workers tend the fungus garden. And then when they get older, they go to foraging for substrate. And then when they get to the next stage of life, they actually take out the trash. And then they actually
get
the
evicted.
Trash.
They become trash.
They actually work in the trash and die in the trash. And so you ask yourself, well, why is it so elaborate? Well, it's actually energetically optimized because the youngest workers have the longest lifespan to serve the colony needs, so they should do the safest tasks. The oldest workers, a worker ant lives maybe 5 or 6 months. The oldest workers have less lifespan left to serve the needs of the colony, or so are less valuable. So the workers change tasks based on age, based on the risk of dying from that task. So the tending the fungus garden is a very safe task. It's deep inside the nest. There's lots of soldier ants around to protect those ants. Foraging is a bit more dangerous because you could get lost. It could rain. You could get
stepped on.
A biologist could pick you up and put you in a vial. All kinds of stuff. And then the last task, or tending the dump, is very dangerous in terms of exposure to disease. So there's an age-based division of labor, but there's also a size-based division of labor. And so there's different size workers in the colony that do different tasks. I just mentioned something about a soldier ant. Well, leaf-cutting ants have one size class that we call soldier ants, and they're about maybe, what's that, about 3 millimeters, a little more than half an inch
right.
long. And these soldiers can bite through leather shoes.
Wow.
So fortunately, they don't sting as well. We're very thankful for that. Like some ants do sting and are less pleasant to work with. But the soldiers can bite through leather shoes. And I actually have a few scars on my hands from soldier ants' bites. But mature leaf-cutting ant nests can have tens of thousands of these soldiers. And when you dig in them into them to collect their fungus garden, they can come pouring out. And it can be quite exciting.
And how do they these workers that when it's time for them to move to that next phase of their life, they're sort of in the senior ant phase, how do they know that?
So getting back to how this is orchestrated, we have very little understanding about this. And part of the challenge is that the complexity of the system in terms of there's some aspect of the queen signaling that's probably playing a role. And some of this may be hardwired. There may be some behavioral components. It's difficult to tease that apart. Even the issue of how workers end up being different sizes is poorly understood.
But you mean they actually come in grades of size? You're not talking about individual differences. You're talking about class distinctions again.
Yeah, because the thing to remember is that the ants that we recognize and see on the pavement that you started the show with and talking about are all adult ants with a hard exoskeleton covering, so they can't grow. So they're permanently that size when they pupate out of their stage. So ants are related to butterflies and other insects that have complete metamorphosis, and they go from egg to larvae to pupae and then to adult. And once they come out of the pupal stage to the adult stage, they're fixed for size. So you have soldier castes that are the biggest that I was describing, but you actually have what we call minima workers, which are very tiny and are difficult to see and might be at most a millimeter long or a millimeter and a half long. And so very tiny, maybe 2 millimeters long, very tiny workers that do different tasks. And those workers typically tend the fungus garden and deal with the fungus, which being very small is a benefit too. And so the size of workers in terms of tasks is kind of optimized in terms of the jobs that they do.
They're born for certain tasks.
What about male-female ants?
Male-female is determined by whether the eggs are fertilized. Males are haploids. They're not fertilized eggs. And then the queens are females that are fertilized, and all the workers are females that are fertilized. I often joke, and some people like this, is that in the leaf-cutting ant world, in all the ant world, it's a female world. And the male ants will be produced for the nuptial flight, and they'll mate with females, and then they die. And so their lifespan is typically a few months, and the queen can live 10 to 15 years.
And then
the workers are female.
How is it determined who becomes queen?
That's a great question. It gets back to what determines what caste the workers are in terms of size. So what determines whether a small worker is small or a big worker or a queen is determined by how much they feed when they're developing. So all the eggs that are laid that are going to turn into queens or workers are fertilized eggs. And every egg is the same and can turn into any of those stages. And what determines what stage is based on when the egg hatches, it becomes a larva, an immature stage that does the feeding. And the more it feeds, the faster it grows and the bigger it grows and the larger the worker it'll be. Queen. So the determination of the size and the caste is based on how much the worker feeds.
And there's something to trigger it to eat or not.
Yes, that's the part we don't understand is that there is some colony level control about how much feeding a larva does. But what determines that is not clear. And the way we know that there's some colony control is the one thing I didn't tell you about the different size castes in this system is that small colonies like human society have a small workers and don't have a range of size of workers. And these small workers do different tasks. They can forage, they can tend the fungus garden. As that colony gets bigger, there's bigger divisions in the sizes. And so there's more distinct size differences. And so it's as the colony gets bigger, there's more specialization in tasks, much like human society in small villages, people are probably more generalist than big cities. You're more specialized in the jobs you do, and it's an increase in efficiency as the colony gets bigger. what a well-known biologist named E.O. Wilson did in the early 80s. He noted this pattern, and what he did is he took large colonies that had a range in worker size, mm-hmm. and he made them small.
Right. What's going to happen?
What's going to happen? And what happened is they returned to having small workers, just the no significant distinction.
Kind of generalists.
Exactly. And so there's some kind of cue there that is determining how much larvae feed that's on a colony level. But what those cues are, we don't know.
So the queen then is
She's the biggest?
There can be only one.
There is only one,
and
yes.
And is she always the biggest
one? She is very big. She is an impressive individual.
We just don't know why she got chosen to be big.
Well,
Is there combat to determine that?
No. What happens to determine who's going to be the queen of the colony is really largely determined a generation before. And so the way these colonies reproduce is that at the beginning of the rainy season, the colonies have to reach sexual maturity, meaning they have to be very large and with millions of workers. And once they reach sexual maturity, that a few months before the rainy season, they'll produce a lot of males and female alates. What we call alates are reproductive ants. And they'll accumulate inside the colony. And then at some point, triggered by factors in the environment we don't completely know, but partly depend on rainfall and the time of the year, the colonies of that species in the population will all release their reproductive ants at the same time, what we call a nuptial flight, and they'll all fly out of the nest, and they'll mate. Females will mate with males. And I forgot to mention this, an important part of the symbiosis is, as I mentioned, having the fungus garden. So they'll carry a pellet of the fungus. The queen will with her on her nuptial flight.
So like a dowry?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, a dowry. And so she'll carry her fungus and she'll mate with some males. And then if she's fortunate, she won't get eaten by a bird or a bat or a small mammal on the ground. And she'll get to mate with males. And then she'll dig up and spit up the fungus garden. A mature nest will produce tens of thousands of reproductives, and the vast majority will die that first night, and only a very small percentage, probably less than 1%, will dig up a new nest and spit up the fungus garden. And so the queen's position in terms of the colony is determined partly by the success of establishing a new nest, growing her fungus. And so she starts with no workers, she'll lay some eggs on a fungus she brought and then slowly build up and then the larvae will develop and then she'll have some workers and the colony will get bigger. And if she's fortunate, 2 or 3 years later, she'll have reached sexual maturity and the colony will start reproducing.
But you still have just what is this, just one survivor, or how is it determined that you have just one queen?
You'll only have one queen established. Each queen will establish a nest on her own.
Oh.
So it's her own. One nest might be very successful producing new colonies, but each queen that successfully established a colony is an independent colony. So the colony that produced the reproductives is still there. You know, it's still a large colony in the population, and it just shoots out these satellite reproductive colonies.
I wanted to find out more about these queens and also, of course, about the fascinating fungus agriculture these ants have, and we'll do that right after this. You're listening to the University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsin residents and businesses save energy and protect the environment by showing them how to live and work more energy efficiently. More information at focusonenergy.com.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Cameron Curry, and we're digging into the life of ants, and it is fascinating indeed. If you thought you knew the basics about ants, you might even be wrong about that. We've been talking about queens, and each one establishes her own colony. What does she do after that? What is the function of the queen?
The queen's job, once she establishes her nest, is largely just laying eggs. And it may be that she produces some pheromones or chemical signals that direct some of the behavior in the colony, but we don't really know very much about that aspect of the system. So largely the way we view it is her as an egg-laying machine, and a leaf-cutting ant queen can lay 60 million eggs in her lifespan. And so she is an amazing egg-laying machine. And one of the fascinating aspects related to this is the queen actually stores sperm in a structure called the spermatheca for the duration of her life. So she's actually able to store sperm for 10, maybe 15 years and keep it viable and use it to fertilize eggs. And so she's a sperm storage egg-laying machine.
This is from one male ant or just whoever happens to be any number of ants?
Most ants have single mating. Most species of ants outside of the fungus-growing ants, the leaf-cutting ant queens that we've been talking about, she may mate with as many as 3 to 5 males.
And just store sperm from all of them.
Yes, yes, exactly.
This is probably a silly question, but is there ever any rebellion? Do you ever see an ant not doing what it's supposed to do?
It's a great question. You know, some people say the ant sits still too long and it might not be working. Within the framework of a single leaf-cutting ant colony, you don't have any opportunity for rebellion, really. Part of it is that the males are sterile and that there's not the kind of conflict that you find in some other social insects, including some other species of ants, where there might be fighting over reproduction between workers and the queen. And so that's not present. But one of the neat things is that there are related species of ants that parasitize these colonies and will come in and usurp the fungus garden and utilize it and produce their own reproductives from the efforts of the parent nest that they're parasitizing.
How do they get away with that?
The thought is that they produce the two ways. They mimic the chemical signature of the colony in terms of nestmate recognition. One of the things that ants have is that they produce compounds on their cuticle that signal to each other that they belong to the same colonies. So guest ants or parasitic ants and other guests can mimic that signature is one method. Another method is they may parasitize ants that have workers that are smaller and not as strong, and they'll actually just usurp them and attack them and sting them and take over the nest. Mm-hmm.
What about the food? We've been talking about the ants, yes. And you know the fungus is part of this system that you're studying. Yeah. What exactly is fungus when you compare it to other things, other kinds of plants?
Fungi are a kingdom in the eukaryotic organisms. And so you have your plants, animals, protists, and fungi kingdoms. I think I'm not forgetting one. I lecture about this. I better not. They're a whole kingdom of organisms. And fungi range, what most people are familiar with, are molds that occur on fruit or on
bread left out. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Or mushrooms. And so the group that the ants culture is related to, the group of the Basidiomycota, we call them, that include most of the mushrooms that we are familiar with. And the life cycle of this group of fungi they culture is that they grow underground. The relatives to the fungi the ants culture are litter decomposers. And so we think that the origin of the fungus in the system is that the ancestor was a fungus that broke down litter growing in the soil, occasionally producing a mushroom above the surface of the forest floor, producing spores to spread. And so we think that the ants domesticated that fungus and started the association, as we talked earlier, maybe 45 to 60 million years ago. And so that's kind of what we know about the ancestor of the fungi. The fungus, in terms of what the ants are culturing, is pretty genetically homogeneous. It's transported between generations by the queen in this pocket that we talked about earlier, and spit up and grown in kind of this hyphal, mycelial, microscopic form on the fungus garden.
And is it similar, other than with mushrooms, is it, if we saw it, would it remind us of anything? What does it look like?
The fungus garden is got this kind of spongy material. In the leaf cutters, the top of the fungus garden where they add the leaf has got a green tint to it, but then there's these little dots of white that cover it, and the dots of white are the fungus. And if you get in really close, it almost might look like white spaghetti. It's almost maybe like spaghetti attached to the plate being the leaf material and the spaghetti, you know, being the threads of the fungus. Part of the reason I think about this is that, you know, the ants will actually care for this, and they'll actually run the threads of the fungus through their mouth parts, which make it look like, you know, cleaning off spaghetti. But it's a whitish color, and it covers the surface. And the lower parts, the older parts of the garden, you just get this real spongy kind of almost cottony look to the fungus garden.
The crux of what you're interested in of late has to do with how the ants managed to keep this fungus healthy.
I started working on fungus-growing ants for my PhD in the late 90s. And what fascinated me about the system is that researchers had recently been studying the evolution of the fungus with the evolution of the ants. And what they found and what they indicated was that the two players, the ants and fungi, have been what we call co-evolving and diversifying together. And so you have an ancient association where you have diversification of the ants and diversification of the crops they maintain. And then they also talked about how the ants maintain their garden clonally propagated in monoculture, and that they're relatively genetically homogeneous. And so as a starting PhD student, I thought, well, human agriculture, when we have monocultures of genetically homogeneous crops, what is our major issue? It's disease, right? And in the literature, it was widely reported the ants were so good at agriculture, they maintained their garden free of disease. And so I actually, for my PhD, thought, well, either A, there might be diseases that weren't known in the garden that hadn't been discovered, or B, there might be really interesting mechanisms employed by the ants to deal with disease, which is why they were able to be free of disease.
And these fungi would be so susceptible because it's such a specialized form of crop now. And we know that if you select too narrowly for your crop, it becomes very susceptible to disease. That the whole idea of genetic diversity is to make you more resistant to disease.
Yeah, exactly. Part of the analogy is if you have a single genetic type, there's a single defense, you know, potentially a single defense mechanism or only a small suite of defense mechanisms. If a pest overcomes that or a disease, then they're able to rapidly spread throughout the crop. Whereas if you have diversity, the disease-causing agent is not able to spread as rapidly and overcome all of the defense mechanisms. And in evolutionary biology, one of the ways we describe this is we call it the Red Queen theory. And this is an interesting theory because it relates to Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, Red Queen. And the idea is that in Through the Looking Glass, the analogy is that Red Queen and Alice are running faster and faster. And Alice says to the Red Queen, well, here we seem to be running faster and faster to stay in the same place. And the Red Queen responds, well, you know, that's the way it is here. And so the analogy in terms of thinking about parasites and hosts is that you need genetic diversity to continually maintain yourself in this race with your parasites. And then if you're not maintaining that diversity, then the parasites might overcome you and wipe you out. And so there's this constant kind of what we might call an evolutionary arms race between the two players.
We see that in the battle between, a poisonous toad and a predatory snake or
exactly,
something. They
exactly.
keep upping the ante between tolerance to the poison and increasing the poison.
Yeah, exactly.
But the fungus that these ants grow, they have it both ways, I gather, because it's a very specialized fungus and yet it's disease-free.
That was the assumption when I started my work, is that the fungus was maintained disease-free. But in fact, there's this third player in the system is specialized parasites that exploit the ant fungus garden. And these are also fungi, but unlike the fungus the ants grow, which are basidiomycetes, the parasite that attacks the fungus garden is what we call ascomycetes. And so it's a different kingdom or phylum of fungi that are doing this, and it's more related to molds than to mushrooms. And so these fungi are only known from the gardens of these ants, and they can have a devastating impact. I've found nests that are in the field that are completely overgrown by this parasitic fungus. The garden's completely devastated.
So this is a fungus, not that the ants are growing, but that just comes in and takes advantage of the garden?
Yeah, and it actually, we've recently shown that it consumes the nutrients of the fungus as its primary food source. And so it exploits the ant's fungus garden as its primary niche. And we've shown that it's co-evolved like with the ants and their cultivar. And so the ants have been dealing with this disease probably from the very earliest stages, and all three players probably date, you know, have had these interactions for 45 to 60 million years.
So what can the ants do to cultivate a clean fungus garden?
The mechanisms they have in place to deal with the pathogen in the fungus garden are quite elaborate, and there's a lot of different methods employed. And one of the methods involves behavior, and anytime you're working with ants, behavior is a critical component. And this is one of the areas we've done a lot of work on the behavioral side of leaf-cutting ants. And the ants actually do this weeding of the fungus garden. I briefly touched on that earlier, and they actually cut out infected parts and discard it in their dumps. And they also will do a behavior we discovered that we call fungus grooming, where they actually clean up and lick up the spores from the fungus garden of the pathogen. So they have specialized behavioral defenses that are pretty adequate and do a good job. You know, it's maybe hard to imagine human farmers out there, you know, completely, you know, cleaning up.
Licking up the chaff.
Yeah, exactly. But pruning is an important mechanism of dealing with disease in some systems. But we have to remember also the ants have a huge workforce of millions of workers to employ in this way. The other defense mechanism is through symbiosis with another fourth player. And these are bacteria associated with the ants that actually produce antibiotics that protect their fungus garden. And this is work that I did as a PhD student. And what we found was that the ants maintain these bacteria on their cuticles, and they'll actually rub the bacteria on infected locations, and the bacteria produces an antibiotic that helps protect the garden and keep the garden clean, and especially against the specialized parasite Ascomopsis.
So what is that equivalent to for people? I'm trying to picture
this. The antibiotic under cuticles
with the bacteria, and
yeah.
I mean, if you take the analogy of the farmer,
it's an antibiotic production, and it might be equivalent of either a herbicide application or maybe application of a fungicide in agricultural systems. If you have fungal diseases in your garden and you're spraying some compound to deal with the disease, that would be the equivalent. And there is a lot of analogies, because the bacteria that the ants maintain in their body, and part of the reason that this idea came to me is that these bacteria are related to a group of bacteria that are called actinobacteria, that this group of bacteria produce 80% or 70 to 80% of the antibiotics that humans use. And so this group of bacteria that the ants associate with, we've exploited extensively for pharmaceutical products to deal with disease of relevance to humans. So there's an interesting analogy there.
But if we're talking about the human experience with antibiotics, after a while, they lose their effectiveness.
That's a great question, and I'll answer that. Just let me step back one thing and say that our current evidence indicates that the bacteria, like the fungus, the ants culture, and the pathogen, it's been associated with the system for tens of millions of years, maybe from the earliest stages. So they've been utilizing bacteria for production of antibiotics for millions of years, probably tens of millions of years. And as you indicated, they've been successfully been able to maintain this without rampant resistance to the antibiotics spreading through the system and breaking it down. And so they've been effectively been able to counter that. We don't fully understand the mechanisms in place to suppress resistance, but what we think is, and some of the work we're doing is getting at this, we think the behavior is critical. And if a resistant strain of the pathogen evolves in an ant garden, the ants remove and discard all of the fungus garden to try to eliminate the spread of the resistant strain. That might be one mechanism. And another mechanism is that they, through the application of behavior and the antimicrobials and maybe a mixture of compounds from the bacteria, they may reduce the selective pressure on evolutionary resistance. Often when we deal with disease, we're applying one single agent, and that is easier to evolve resistance to. So there's possible mechanisms in place, and some of the work we're doing now is trying to get at, can we learn lessons for dealing with evolution of antibiotic resistance in a natural system by studying the fungus-growing ants?
Good question.
More on ants, fungus, and what it means for us when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Our knowledge of the social insects and the phenomenon of the superorganism they so beautifully display has grown immensely during the past century, yet we have only begun to explore this alien world. About 14,000 species of ants are known, for example, but twice that number or more are likely to exist. Of those known, fewer than 100 can be said to have been well studied. Where do we go from here? That's a passage from the book The Superorganism, The Beauty, Elegance, and Strangeness of Insect Societies by Hurt Holdabler and Edward O. Wilson. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Cameron Curry, and we are talking about ants, fungus, and us. How does the species of ants that you're studying so well fit within this huge area of ants?
The group of ants we work on belong in a tribe called Atini, and they're composed of 12 genera of ants and maybe about 210 species of described ants of that 14,000. But there are probably many more species than 200, and you know, the estimates could be maybe as many as 1,000 species of fungus growing ant. We really actually have no idea the full diversity. And when you go in and you look at species, you often find that things that you thought were a single species are multiple species. Maybe in terms of species diversity, it's a small but a significant component.
Pretty amazing, though, to think of all those ants that are out there not being studied. In terms of what this might mean for us, you were mentioning that some of the bacteria that the ants have as part of the system, that this is something that's been there for millions of years. Could it be that in the ant colonies that you're studying right now, you're sitting on some pretty exciting pharmaceutical discoveries?
The quick answer is we hope so, and we think so. As I mentioned earlier, different species of ants and different groups of ants, they've co-evolved with their fungi and the parasite, and so a different species associate with different fungi that they culture, and there's different pathogens that attack their nest. And just like the fungus they culture and the pathogen being different, there's different strains of bacteria associated with different species of these ants. And so there's a lot of diversity in the bacteria that are producing the antibiotics in the ant system, in the fungus growing ant system. And our early indications are that across this diversity, there's different antibiotics, different compounds being produced across the diversity. So there's a lot of different small molecules, which are what we call antibiotics, to be discovered. And the first we recently published on the first compound that we've worked up on from the bacterium. And this is in collaboration with John Clardy, a professor at Harvard University. And this compound we found was novel to science, had never been described before. And it's actually been screened for application in a few different ways and has some promising activity.
So where do we see this in terms of our own agricultural development? Are there going to be lessons from ant fungus growers, leaf cutters that will apply to the way we practice agriculture, do you think?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. Farmers walking around with bacteria on their bodies.
On their cuticles.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think the analogy to human farming is, I think, a little bit harder because of the scales and stuff. I think in terms of there may be insights into thinking about evolution of antibiotic resistance, thinking about evolution of antibiotic production. It may inform on us in ways of discovering new antibiotics. And for example, since my discovery, people work in my lab and others in other places have looked for these types of associations with other insects and are finding them. And we've recently published on another antibiotic that we discovered from a non-ant system but a beetle system that associate with fungi. And we discovered they have bacteria that produce antibiotics as well, and there's novel compounds. So this can inform on where to look for discovering new antibiotics, and we're really excited about that possibility. And so there's some applied aspects that relate to drug discovery and dealing with disease and evolution of disease.
Are there other practical applications that you can see coming out of the work?
There is another angle that there's a range of different aspects that, you know, people are looking at in terms of the ants for applied things, you know, things that other labs are doing are looking at longevity, you know, to understand senescence for aging issues in terms of understanding health. People are looking at sperm storage, like how you keep viable sperm for 10 to 15 years.
Get rid of those men.
Get rid of those men, exactly. Yeah, that's the goal, right, is if we can just store sperm long enough. So the area we're working in my lab is related to the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center at the University of Wisconsin. This is a DOE-funded, Department of Energy-funded program in the area of bioenergy and specifically producing ethanol from cellulose, the recalcitrant, difficult to decompose components.
Yeah, to break down that cell wall. That's the holy grail there of wood pulp ethanol.
We're funded as part of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center to study the ant system and other related systems to understand how within this system they rapidly decompose plant biomass to produce energy for the ants. And so the ants have the same issue. They're using plant biomass to produce energy and they utilize microbes to do it. And so we're looking at the process of plant cell wall degradation in the ant system to inform on cellulosic ethanol.
Just out of curiosity, maybe the basic ant longevity isn't long enough to even look at, but how healthy are ants? Do they have pretty good immune systems?
We don't know very much about the ant immune system. We know very little, and it's a little beyond my area of expertise. I'm part of a team of scientists who have received an award to sequence the genome of the leaf-cutting ant. And so we actually, you know, as part of that effort, we'll be able to get insights into their immune system. But there's currently no published genome of any ant, and so we have limited insights into that. But ants in general, I think, are pretty hardy.
How long do you think it'll take to do an ant genome project?
That's a great question. We're discovering that. The challenge is with new sequencing technology, you're actually able to get a generating the data fairly quickly and much faster than in the past. But putting it all together and figuring out what the different parts of the genome are, what genes are there, and annotating it, what we call annotating it, is a major undertaking. So we're hopeful that we're going to finish something in the next 12 months or so.
And how are you going to apply that then, the ant genome?
How do we apply that?
Yes. What are you going to do with it once you have it?
Oh, we're going to celebrate. It's going to be very exciting. When you have a genome, you can get at different questions, and it allows you to get at kind of the molecular underpinnings of some of the associations. And so the major thing we're doing and interest in my lab is really actually studying from a genomics perspective the whole community. And so we think about, I think it's appropriate to refer to Darwin this year in terms of the 200th anniversary.
Yes.
and of his birth and the 150th anniversary of Origin of Species. And my favorite passage is the Tangled Bank in Origin of Species. And Darwin speaks about this interconnections of organisms in this complex communities and how this is shaped evolution and this complexity is shaped by evolution. And so we are studying the evolution of the community of organisms associated with the ants, including the ants, by using genomic approaches. And so sequencing the ant genome will give us that additional component because we're sequencing the genome of the microbes as well.
And if we have you on 5 years from now, what do you hope you'll know about this ant community that you don't know now?
What we hope to know is understand the molecular underpinning of the evolution of the system. And so it's one of those things where when you have the genome, every question you're interested in, you know, it can inform on almost every question you're interested in. And a good example is by sequencing the genome of the bacteria that produce antibiotics, we can actually understand the production of the antibiotic and whether, you know, and they can get at evolution of antibiotic resistance because we can actually look for signatures of rapid selection of new compounds being produced, which would reflect kind of evolution of resistance selecting for rapid changes in new chemistry being produced. A lot of the questions that we've been talking about, we can get at new enzymes that can break down plant cell walls through mining genomes and these kinds of things.
Do you think it would also get at why certain ants become workers and so on? Would it help us to understand the social structure?
Ultimately, this kind of approach is going to be huge for understanding what factors contribute to what casts an individual ends up, longevity, stuff like that. These are critical. And we won't get the answer by just looking at the genome, but having the genome allows us to study the expression of different genes and under different conditions.
What excites you the most about ants after all the – I mean, I assume you're not blasé yet.
Well, you know, I've often thought that I would lose interest in fungus-growing ants and start wanting to switch systems. And before working on fungus-growing ants, I worked on a few different groups of organisms and got – lost some interest, but I'm continually surprised with new discoveries in the ant system. So I'm not becoming bored with them at all yet. I think the fungus growing ants or that agricultural association really kind of makes for a lot of very interesting and cool aspects. One of my favorite stories is I've collected maybe 1,000, 2,000 nests of fungus growing ants or leaf cutting ants, and about 2 years ago I went to Panama. And the first nest that I dug, I'd been in Panama and spent a year of my life or more in Panama digging nests. And one of the first nests that I dug, I found this little chamber beside the colony, and it was full of these worms that were squirreling beside the garden. And I'd only seen this one other time, and it was the first nest I collected in Trinidad of my very first time in the field studying these ants. I'd never seen it for 1,000 colonies. And I thought, well, this is interesting. This is a little bit different. And then I got a new search image and thought, well, they're kind of found a little bit far away from the chamber. And I started looking for them, and I found them in 4 out of 12 nests I collected in the next 2 days. And so I discovered this totally new thing. What we did was we actually did work on these worms, and they actually feed on the fungus and they parasitize the system. Completely unknown, undiscovered, and just after thousands of nests, you can go in and you can make a very neat discovery by just, you know, digging in the wrong spot.
And if only those ants now could figure out what to do about the worms, they'd be one step ahead of that too.
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us, Cameron Curry, enlightening us about what proves to be very fascinating, just the tip of the nest, you might say, in the world of ants. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.